There's a best-selling new book out called Justice on Trial. The subtitle is The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. The book is written by Molly Hemingway and Kerry Severino, and the book is really going strong, which is fantastic. In fact, at one point, it was number one on Amazon, and it's my understanding that's for all categories. Right now, we're going to talk with Kerry Severino, one of the co-authors of this book. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Yeah, we're so excited to, on our opening day, shoot up to number one there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay. So, Kerry Severino, let me just say this briefly, is Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And Kerry, tell us what your organization is all about, and then we'll get right into the book.
Yeah, so I work for a group called the Judicial Crisis Network, and we're dedicated to ensuring that we have constitutionalist judges put on the Supreme Court and the other federal courts and on your state courts. So we are advocating for those judges, and we were the major outside group who was advocating for Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation.
Okay, now I watched a lot of those hearings about a year ago or 8 months, whatever it was, 10 months ago. Very, very carefully. I'm sure you did. You probably were there. But it was amazing to me because, I mean, I knew he was going to get some fireworks or whatever, but within 30 seconds of Senator Charles Grassley, as I recall, the chairman of the whole committee, he's speaking. Within 30 seconds, he gets interrupted by Kamala Harris, would-be presidential candidate now, Senator Harris from California, on some technical details, and then just one thing after another, it seemed like they pulled out all the stops to derail this man's nomination.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't watch a lot of C-SPAN, which is a position I totally endorse, this is not normal. This was a really extraordinary hearing to have senators interrupting each other like that, and we learned later they had actually had a call of the Democratic senators in the committee to kind of strategize how are we going to make this hearing really extreme.
And they just please get your mouth closer to the mic.
But, oh, sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. We learned they were strategizing this on the phone ahead of time because they wanted to make him seem like a more extreme nominee, basically by the extreme way they were handling themselves. And it was interesting also, Chuck Grassley, you know, the 80-some-year-old committee chair who is not used to this stuff, he decided to actually let it go and say, you know what, I'm going to let them just give them enough rope to hang themselves. And so when protester after protester was standing up, being dragged out, 200 people arrested over the course of those hearings, it really ended up backfiring in a lot of ways because the American people saw how ridiculous this opposition was. And more importantly, for the confirmation's sake, many of those undecided and moderate senators said, this is ridiculous. This is not appropriate behavior for senators.
Okay, I'm sure you were expecting that they would do everything they could to derail him, but do you think that they hit below the belt? Were you surprised at all by the way the whole thing worked out, including Ms. Ford and her testimony?
Yeah, I have to say, going in with expectations, it would be a circus. I was surprised. I was telling people ahead of time, you know, they're going to misrepresent his record. They did that. They're going to maybe attack him personally. They did that. But I always stopped short of saying this could be the most contentious confirmation hearing ever because I clerked for Justice Thomas. You know, everyone who lived through that saw those hearings and said, it's never going to get that bad again. And it did. It, in fact, got worse. Thomas was never accused of the level of things that Kavanaugh was accused of, from serial gang rape. They were saying he had been on a nationwide, sex crime spree. This was totally ludicrous, and it was a real new low in our confirmation process.
Yeah. And tell us about the Ford accusations, because it's my understanding that some of those things even changed so that if you were to take the original thing she had said when she was accusing Kavanaugh of, you know, having tried to molest her or whatever, rape her, she had a different date. And if you were to stick her with that particular date that she had said initially, he was already in Connecticut by then and could not have been the man in question in that testimony, but they kind of morphed things around so that he would become the guilty person.
Yeah, some of her date ranges changed. Originally, she said it was 82 to 84. Then she said, oh, no, definitely 1982. You know, some of her descriptions of the party changed. She said, you know, various different things at different points, whether it was talking to the Washington Post, talking to her alleged notes to her therapist that no one ever really saw, so we're not sure what they said. But the Post reported they said there were four boys in the room. That's not what she says was even accurate. Sometimes she says there was a girl there, sometimes a couple girls. It's very confusing. And that was one of the things that Rachel Mitchell, the prosecutor who was brought in by the Republicans to do questioning, mentioned as a real red flag for her. She said there's some things that having interviewed, and her job is interviewing victims of sex crimes, there's some things that didn't raise antennas for her, like even waiting decades to talk about it is something that happens with some regularity with sex crimes. But the way that the details changed without any real reason that she would know more or less about it, that really was something that casts a lot of doubt on the veracity of the claim, not to mention some of the inconsistencies, like not knowing how you got home from this event, that in 1982, when there's no cell phones, no Uber, in an area that there aren't taxis going down the street. And, you know, Molly and I, writing this book, we drove the path from Columbia Country Club to the house that her family was living at the time. And let me tell you, that's not a way you can get home without having someone help you. She couldn't drive at the time. Some of those things really were inconsistencies or holes in the story that definitely undermined its credibility.
And another thing, too, is that he was held to a standard of, well, look at this. He reflects immature behavior as a high schooler.
Yes. I mean, well, so there's certainly some people were going down, you know, criticizing every yearbook entry he had, criticizing the fact that he and his friends were drinking beer. I think that's, you know, we can't all be judged by the things in high school. Now, if we are going around attempting to rape people in high school, that certainly is something that yeah. is a different category. However, you can't assume that this happened based on an allegation that has no corroborating evidence. In fact, all the evidence that did come out tended to make it less likely that what she was telling is true, not just the inconsistencies, but also all of the people that she named as having been at the event, including her own close friend, Leland Kaiser, who was one of her best friends from Holton Arms, the all-girls school they went to, and who testified first just that she did not remember this happening, didn't think she knew who Brett Kavanaugh was, didn't remember any such party, but as we tell in Justice on Trial, later on actually grew to doubt Ford's own accuracy because she started going back through that summer, remembered many aspects well, and then realized there was a lot about this story that doesn't line up with what I remember from that summer.
Did Ford have a presence on the internet before her testimony in the Kavanaugh hearings? And the reason I ask is because it's my understanding she did, but she kind of somehow they expunged all that.
Absolutely. She was presented, and it was a very carefully cultivated rollout when she was, you know, brought out as the named victim for the first time. But she was described as someone who was maybe liberal, but not terribly political. Well, we had the opportunity to talk with people familiar with her Facebook pages before this happened, and they said that's not actually accurate. She was, one person said, crazy liberal. And, you know, you all know the friends. We've all got friends who are at extremes on both sides in social media. Of course, before the allegations were made public, those pages were completely scrubbed. Not just I, you know, deleted my page, but professionally done. So this was something, this was a side that didn't fit with the narrative that was being presented and clearly was calculatedly removed so that wouldn't interfere with the story they were trying to tell.
When she was testifying in those hearings, she was unusual, you know, and it's almost, I don't want to use the word baby talk, but she had this kind of, you know, like this poor person who's been victimized by what happened 40, 50 years ago or whatever, and it's still with her. Is that the way she teaches when she's a, you know, she's a professor, right? I understand. And how does that work? Are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah. You know, that was one of the interesting things we learned. And we tried to just tell the story as accurately as I could. A lot of people thought, that's a crazy voice. She must be making fun of this. But we talked to some people who knew her in high school and said, oh yeah, some people called her baby love because that was, you know, because of her voice. So that may be one of those things that's just truth is stranger than fiction.
Oh, okay. What is the genesis of this book? I mean, at what point did you and Molly say, oh my goodness, we got to write a book about this?
Yeah, well, we both really, I mean, and all of America lived through this, but we were working on it, her as a journalist, me as an advocate, and we would talk with each other a lot in the process because she would call me for comments on things. So we knew a lot about the stories that were out there, and we knew that they hadn't all been told fully before. And, you know, as someone who clerked for Justice Thomas, I also had seen the next phase in this campaign, because this is all straight out of the playbook of what happened with Thomas. You have attempts to misconstrue his previous record. When that doesn't work, there's a leaked allegation from the Judiciary Committee, the second set of hearings, the women who knew them at the time saying this doesn't line up at all with the person we knew. There are so many parallels. But the next phase in the Thomas hearings was he gets confirmed, and they don't just pack up and go home. There begins a decades-long propaganda campaign to convince America that actually this was true, even though at the time that it happened, the people who watched it and were there, 2-1 believed Thomas. I knew this could happen again with Justice Kavanaugh. So we decided we have all these amazing access to people inside the process. We're going to tell the true story because that will help explain to people what really happened. And also because we don't want to forget all of the games that were played this time. We know there will be more Supreme Court vacancies. And unfortunately, we don't have any reason to believe that the politics are going to get dialed down next time. So, you know, knowledge is power, helping people understand what happened so they can be prepared, unfortunately, if it tries to happen again.
And in the case of Ford, before we totally leave her, what do you think happened to her? I mean, do you think there was a real incident? She just had the wrong guy in the wrong year even?
You know, we explore a lot of things. We don't take a position on that. We want to just kind of put the facts out there that we do know. But one of the things we also did was speak to memory experts who said, first of all, that her description of, you know, you remember the words indelible on the hippocampus, that because of the trauma, certain things are indelible. And they said, no, nothing, in fact, is indelible in the memory. That's the one thing everyone has to realize. However, it was interesting to learn about the malleability of memory. So I don't know what exactly happened, but I do know it's actually very possible to have memories that can be reshaped and formed over the years, whether that's from external influence or just from environmental things that are happening. And so, you know, we can't really say with certainty, is this something that she was mistaken about, consciously telling a different story than she knew. I just think the evidence is pretty clear that whatever the story is, it doesn't line up with the idea that Brett Kavanaugh was the person who did this.
Okay, excellent. We have 1.5 minutes to go. They really tried to ruin his reputation, and then they would turn around and mock him. For example, I saw the segment on Saturday Night Live. Matt Damon plays mm-hmm. him, and he's blowing his nose, and he's crying, and he's angry. I mean, I would be very upset if my reputation were in tatters based on misinformation.
Absolutely. I mean, this is someone who, before this happened, was not just someone with a stellar reputation. I think amongst the federal judiciary, he was someone with maybe the most stellar reputation as a judge, as a human being. And actually, the fact that so many women who knew him through all these years were willing to stand up and testify, they said, I wouldn't do this for, you know, 5 other people in my life, but he's someone who I just know so well. This is absolutely out of character with him. He's so respectful. So having that kind of person now for the rest of his life, a significant number of people are going to say, well, that's a serial gang rapist. That is a really difficult thing. So I think it's the emotion is not surprising that we saw there. But his role as a judge is obviously very different. We've seen him on the court for a year now. He certainly is able to return to his judicial temperament, you know, when you don't have the entire nation accusing you of horrific crimes.
All right. Your Twitter handle is at JCN Severino, SEVERINO. Again, the name of the book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. And 15 seconds to go. Do you think that ultimately a lot of this controversy gets back to abortion, to be honest?
I think it's that, and it's many issues where the court has taken over for what should be things decided in the political branches. If the Constitution doesn't speak to it, then the courts aren't the ones to rewrite the laws. That has to be the American people. So anytime the court takes that out, the left wants to use the courts to move it to the left. We just need judges like Kavanaugh who say it like it is, and if they want to change the laws, do it in the proper venues with the elected representatives.
Justice on Trial. Thanks so much, Carrie, for being with us. All the best.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.